Right. So we are here today with the Lewis brothers, Hiram Lewis and Vernon Lewis. Can you say hi to everybody out in Substack land, guys?
Hello, good
And
to be here.
we are talking about their new book, or actually, it's about a book about a year old, The Myth of Left and Right. I am here with my best friend in the world, Robin Hanson. So just to get started, let's get your background, right? We got two brothers who co-author. What in the world's going on?
Well,
Maybe
I'll just
go ahead.
I'll just give Hiram the credit here. This is definitely his ideas behind this book, and definitely he's the primary author, but he was kind enough to bring me along. But I remember about, oh, I don't know, 15 years ago, we were having a conversation, and he was, pointing out the what should have been obvious fact to me at the time, but I hadn't really considered it before, the fact that the meanings of conservatism and liberalism, left and right, are constantly evolving. And it's a pretty basic and now I think obvious point, but I haven't been able to stop thinking about it since, because I think the way most people talk about politics is that no, these are entrenched, enduring philosophies that have universal meaning across time and space. And I think that's one of the most foundational assumptions of our contemporary political discourse, but it's just completely false.
All right, cool. But who are you? Just like I just want everybody to know, like who are you? What's your quick deal? Where are you? What's your affiliation? Just want to hear that
Yeah,
real
go
fast.
for it, Hiram.
Yeah, I'm currently a professor of history at BYU Idaho. I was previously a visiting scholar at Stanford University, and then I did my doctorate at the University of Southern California.
All right. And how about you, Verlin?
Yeah, so I'm a professor at Utah Valley University. Previously, I was in Colorado and did my PhD at the University of Virginia in political science. So, Hiram and I study a lot of the same things. Enjoy working together. His degrees in history, mine's in political science, but there's a lot of overlap in what we do.
All right, cool. All right, so now let me just get the basic ideas of the book, The Myth of Left and Right, on the table. All right, so guys, what is the essentialist theory of ideology and what is the alternative?
Maybe I can chime in and then Verlin can flesh it out. So the essentialist theory of ideology is the idea that there's only one issue in politics. And this is obviously false. It should be pretty common sense that there's many, many issues. And a lot of people would say, well, of course there's many issues. You're attacking a straw man. Nobody believes there's just one issue in politics, but actually pretty much everybody does, because almost everybody, at least politically active people, describe politics using a political spectrum. And a unidimensional spectrum, by definition, can only model one issue. So if we're using a spectrum to model politics, we are assuming one issue underlying it. And for most people, they would say it's the question of progress or change versus conservation. Conservatives, as their name indicates, like to conserve. Progressives, as their name indicates, like to progress. So all these issues that seem unrelated, if I was talking to Senator Elizabeth Warren, for instance, and I went down the list of all the things the Democratic Party currently believes and says, which of these do you agree with? She'd say, I agree with all of them. And I'd say, well, that's you're being a lemming. Why do you just happen to agree with your party on everything? Can't you think for yourself? And she'd say, I am thinking for myself. I have a political philosophy of progressivism. And that progressive philosophy leads me to believe in abortion rights for women, higher taxes on the rich, more action on climate change, opposing the death penalty, more immigration, and all those things. For her, there is just one big issue. Do you believe in progress, or do you want to be a conservative and stop that progress? So, one issue in politics. So, that's the essentialist theory. And our argument is that that's false. So, what is Elizabeth Warren doing? Why does she agree with all those things? We say she's conforming to her tribe. She believes what she does because she anchored into the Democratic Party and the left-wing slash progressive tribe and has adopted all of the policies of that tribe as a matter of socialization. So, what we call progressive policies are simply policies that are bound together by tribe, not essence. Maybe Verlin could add to that.
No, I would just reiterate that. So I think in ordinary discourse, when most people say things like left or right, if they're not being confused, they're just talking about social groups. And so we would encourage people to give up the language of left and right because that implies something false. When you talk about left and right, you're implying that there's some philosophy that binds together all of the issue positions that currently fly under that banner. But really, these are just social groups whose issue positions are constantly changing. So it would be more accurate just to talk about Republicans and Democrats, just talk about social groups rather than pretending that someone who is pro-life on abortion policy also has to be in favor of tax cuts, also has to be against military aid to Ukraine, also has to be against immigration or whatever the issue is.
All right, so I've got one more softball question. If I know Robin, he has zero softball questions. So one more softball question, then we're all done with softball. All right, last softball question. What are the leading essentialist theories of ideology and what is wrong with them? You already started with one, this conserving versus progressing, but there's a bunch of others, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. So
go for it, Iron.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, so that's, you know, you can almost, Garrett, you almost know what tribe somebody belongs to by what they propose is the essence, because it's always loading the dice in their favor, right? Like, so if I talked to a conservative and said, what is your conservative philosophy? They probably wouldn't accept Senator Warren's premise that they're against progress. They would say, no, a conservative is somebody who believes in realism. They believe in reality. And a liberal or a progressive is somebody who's detached from reality, who's a utopian, who can't accept reality the way it is. So it's realism versus utopian idealism. That's how they would put it. That's another one.
It's like Thomas Sowell's divisions.
Exactly. And that one's gotten a lot of traction because Thomas Sowell is a very smart guy. I agree with, 95% of what he says. But on that one, we just think he's terribly wrong.
What about some others?
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, some of these, again, are so self-serving. A lot of times I hear this, especially, being an academic. So most of my colleagues are people who identify as part of Team Blue. They consider themselves part of the progressive tribe. And, I was at a political science conference a couple of years ago, and someone said, well, the real difference between liberals and conservatives is liberals care about poor people and conservatives don't care about poor people. And he said, that's the essential enduring, whatever else changes on trade policy or on racial policy, that's the main thing. I just don't think that's true, right? If you go and talk to someone who identifies as conservative, they won't say, yeah, I'm a conservative because I hate poor people. They'll say, no, I care about poor people. And I think the following issues, positions actually help people who are impoverished, right? And so I think that's another one we get a lot. The realism versus idealism is one we hear a lot. Hierarchy versus equality is one. I think in the post-war era,
orientation, right?
Yeah, right. So the Adorno crew, and a lot of actually people who identified as conservatives in the post-war era, I think kind of took this one on. It was proposed by Team Blue and Team Red decided to adopt it. And they said, we're more in favor of hierarchy and instead of equality. But I just don't think that's true. I don't think the historical record shows that to be true. I mean, currently our politics is dominated by a singular figure by the name of Donald Trump, who is maybe the most populist president of my lifetime. And he's considered extremely right-wing. I mean, there's nothing that connects hierarchy or equality with left or right. The meanings of these terms are always changing.
All right, how about Robin? Pass it off to you.
So I was initially inclined to pick at some of your words to try to like find your mistakes exactly how you worded things, but that doesn't seem so productive to me. So let me instead summarize what I would agree with and then make an analogy and then ask a key question. So my summary might be, say we had the analogy between two neighboring nations, like where's the border and what determines that border? And most of us will admit there's some arbitrary element to that, but there's also some correlations, like, they may follow rivers or something. And if we think about, say, the difference between the East or the West, or two nations, or even men versus women, I think we can all agree that with respect to these big divisions, we tend to idealize them, as we simplify them in our mind. We tend to, we suppress, more variation. We project them down to a smaller dimension than there really is. We think of our side as better than it is. And we tend to forget about how we got there. We tend to presume that we would have been on this side no matter what and forget about the path that put us on one side and not the other. And we also sort of forget about how these things change over time. Like male versus females change, East versus West has changed, left versus right has changed. So I think these are things we can agree on, that when we're on one side, when we're tribal, as you say, when we pick a side, we tend to idealize the difference, simplify the difference, and forget about what led us there and forget about how these things are changing. I think we can agree that's roughly what you're saying. You might overstate the case by saying there's absolutely nothing else going on, and I don't really care about arguing about that. But my key question would be, okay, people are tribal sometimes with respect to these things. You're saying, don't be tribal. Haven't we tried that approach, just saying don't be tribal? I mean, does that really work, telling people not to be tribal? I mean, what exactly, I mean, surely you got to expect people to be tribal, right?
And we do.
Surely these are part of what you expect people to do when they have a tribe. You expect them, yes, to idealize it. You expect them to emphasize the good parts and suppress the awkward parts in order to be loyal to their tribe, right? Just seem loyal to their tribe. Everybody does expect these things of your tribe. You're going to be this about your profession, about your city, about your sports teams, everything that you are allied to, you're going to be tribal in this way. So the key question is, well, you know, how do you expect people not to do that? Or what exactly are you asking for?
Yeah. So as we indicated in our last chapter, of course, human beings are going to be tribal. There's no question about that. You can't eradicate the tribal element in the human psyche. It's going to be there. But the bottom line is you can direct those tribal tendencies in healthy directions. And so there are good tribes and there are bad tribes. So civic organizations, religions, the Tocquevillian voluntary associations, those are good tribes. So we would say, yes, you're going to be tribal, but direct those tribal tendencies in healthy directions. What we're saying is that ideological tribes are bad tribes. So there's good tribes and bad tribes, and these are some of the bad tribes. And so we're not saying don't be tribal, we're saying being the right kind of tribal. Okay, the second thing about you have to expect people are going to idealize their tribes. Sure, but I loved your sports analogy, Robin. Is it okay if I call you Robin?
Sure.
Yeah, I love the sports analogy because you say people are tribal about their sports teams. Absolutely, I'm a big New York Jets fan. I'm gonna love the New York Jets. But I haven't, you know, idealized, I haven't attributed an essence to Jet players. I haven't said all the Jets are connected by some fundamental characteristics such as speed or hard work or aggressiveness or something like that. So if that's what you mean by idealizing, we don't do that in sports. I used to cheer against Aaron Rodgers. This year, I'm going to be the world's biggest Aaron Rodgers fan, right? Same thing happens in politics. Liberals used to be the biggest fans in the world of free speech, and then it switched tribes, and now they oppose free speech. We say that's for the exact same reason that I used to be an Aaron Rodgers fan, and now I'm not. So are the New York Jets a healthy tribe? I would say so, or at least at the very worst, they're a harmless tribe. Whereas deluding ourselves is harmful. So we're not against the tribalism. And are people going to be tribal about politics? Yes. If you want to be a hardcore Republican and love the Republican Party and raise money for the Republican Party, knock yourself out. But what we are saying is do not delude yourself that everything the Republican Party is philosophically connected. That's like trying to say that every New York Jets player is philosophically connected by some essential characteristic. And that's not true. What does abortion have to do with tax cuts? Nothing, except that. So what we need to do is look at our political bundles, look at our parties and see them as unrelated bundles of issues. They're like, you know, random selections of groceries at the grocery store. There's basket A and basket B. I can buy basket A, the Republican Party, and say, yeah, I like the things in basket A better than basket B. But for us, it would be a terrible mistake to delude yourself. No, everything in basket A is better than everything in basket B. And then when things go from basket B to basket A, they throw in some Twinkies or something, say, well, actually, I like Twinkies all along. And let me explain to you why they fit the essence that I had. That's exactly what we're doing in politics. Every time issues switch from left tribe to right tribe, we make up stories to say, well, actually, this is why opposing free speech really is left wing, when you were in favor of it just a year before. Verlin, I probably have something to add there.
Yeah, no, I like that analogy. I think the sports team one is really useful. But to Hiram's point, there's healthier tribes and less healthy tribes, or there's harmless tribes. You know, we don't have violence in the streets right now because people are Jets fans versus Giants fans. But we do have violence in the streets because of our ideological tribalism. We do have people showing up at Nancy Pelosi's house and Brett Kavanaugh's house with ideas about murdering them because they have convinced themselves that they are on the correct side of a unidimensional political spectrum. They are correct about every issue position because their philosophy makes them correct about every issue position. And this other person on the other side of the political spectrum is wrong about everything and is taking this country down the tubes because they are not just wrong on a few things, they disagree on on more things than they agree with the other party. No, they're wrong about everything. They are a threat to the Republic. We have to murder these people, or we have to storm the Capitol building to stop the peaceful transition of power. We are at a breaking point in our politics because of this diluted ideological tribalism.
All right.
And if I could just chime in, sorry, Brian, can I just say one more thing really quick? Excuse me. Because you say, Robin, and it's a great point. It's a great question about, you know, the pervasiveness of tribalism. However, this element of tribalism has been on the increase. So when it comes to, aren't people going to idealize their political tribes? We did it much less in the past. The data shows that people didn't think nearly as much in terms of left-wing and right-wing in the past. In fact, before 1919, they didn't think in those terms at all. So somebody like Abraham Lincoln said, there's slavery and there's tariffs and there's two different issues, and they're both Republican things, but somebody can be with me on the slave issue and not with me on the tariff issue because they're not philosophically connected. So we were less tribal about politics and ideology in the past. So we're not asking for something impossible, and we know it's not impossible because America used to be less ideologically tribal.
All right, Lewis Brothers. So for what belief systems, if any, is essentialism true? So like Aristotelianism, Kantianism, utilitarianism, Marxism, libertarianism, Mormonism. Like, is essentialism wrong for all of these, or are there some where the essentialist theory is actually correct?
Yeah, so this is one that we've talked about before. I would say that people can be coherent in their philosophical belief systems. The trouble with left-right thinking and using terms like liberal and conservative, or one of the problems with it, is that these terms have public meaning. And these terms are bound up with political parties whose issue positions are constantly changing. So what is a conservative today? It's no more, no less than someone who is a Republican.
Sure. Let's grant that. But still, so what is essentialist? So what are some belief systems that actually do meet your standard of essentialism? So like Marxism, is this just a grab bag of a bunch of junk that a guy named Karl Marx thought? Or is there some or is there some internal logic to it such that it flows out naturally from the premises or something in between? Again, same thing for libertarianism, Mormonism, or basically like, tell me, what are the worldviews where essentialism is the correct view of the correct meta theory of the system?
Yeah, well, we'd have to take it one by one, right? But we're both Latter-day Saints, Verlin and I, and we believe that Mormonism is essential, that there are 13 articles of faith, and those haven't evolved. Then you can say, well, hasn't there been evolution in the Mormon tribe? Absolutely, but there are those essential things that haven't changed. You could say the same about Christianity. I would say the same is true of libertarianism. Thus far, libertarianism is a coherent philosophy that believes in freedom from government. And so it is a useful heuristic to use. And so, again, this is a deep philosophical issue that you guys know, right? It's Dewey versus Plato, essentially, or William of Ockham versus Plato. Nominalism versus essentialism. If you're Dewey, you say, well, there are no essences. There's none. There's just useful and less useful. We are not going to wade into that debate between, you know, because this is ongoing. It's eternal. Dewey versus Plato, this whole thing. We're not going to solve that in our book, of course. But regardless of which position you take, whether you're a Deweyite who believes there's no essences, they're simply concepts and words are instruments and tools, well, then what you're going to do is you're going to look for more useful instruments or tools. Or if you're Plato, you think, no, underneath these words is an essence, that the word dog refers to an eternal essence that exists in the realm of forms, right? I mean, there's two different perspectives, but regardless of which perspective, essentialism fails because the idea, the political spectrum
always,
is not
you're
useful.
Saying, you're saying it doesn't always fail. So you say for Mormonism, that actually the essentialism is the right meta theory of Mormonism. It's what it is. You can disagree with Mormonism, but you should still agree that it's a coherent body of thought. Is that
true? True. But my point is that even if there are no such things as essences, we're still right to critique the political spectrum, because it's not useful. So Dewey said, well, we use tools that are useful. There's no essence behind anything, but some concepts are useful concepts. And so we point out that the political spectrum fails even on a nominalist perspective, even if we reject all essences and just look for useful concepts to grab onto. The political spectrum it's neither true nor useful, I guess is a simple way to put it.
So on page 2425, you guys say that in the 30s and 40s, U.S. national politics was mainly one issue, and that the one-dimensional description was accurate then. So in that case, there was an essence. Are you going to still make the claim that it was a useless essence? There was no point to it? Or was it is it only useless when there isn't an essence?
Verlin, do you want to jump in? Okay. Sorry to dominate the conversation here.
No.
Yes. So I would say there was an essence. I mean, I'm a philosophical essentialist. So I would say there is such a thing as more government and less government. That's real and it's useful. And FDR was increasing the size of government. That was real. So if we're modeling that one issue on a spectrum and saying more government versus less government, FDR wants more, Taft wants less, I'm on board with that. I'm okay with using a spectrum to describe more versus less. For the same reason I'm okay using this a spectrum to describe, say, hot versus cold, or more money in my bank account versus less money in my bank account. These are real essential things. So back then it was useful because it was true. National politics was about one big issue. The issues that are on the table today, you know, affirmative action, nobody was talking about that back. FDR wanted to keep race out of it. He wanted to keep blacks and Southern racists in his coalition. So he kept race and affirmative action and all that stuff wasn't there. Abortion, it's not debated. If you look back at the history of the 1930s, nobody's talking abortion. That's not a national issue. If it had been, it would have been a left-wing issue as far as I can tell. The same way that if race was an issue, it would have been a left-wing issue. More racism was considered liberal, less racism was considered conservative, and so on and so forth. So he kept it about one issue. So it was useful in the 1930s. But in the late 1940s, then we get this issue of interventionism versus or anti-communism versus, you know, kind of the McCarthyite thing was more government intervention, but it was considered right-wing, complicated it more. Then race became an issue in the 1960s. We get abortion coming online in the 70s. So as we added dimensions to politics, we should have thrown out a unidimensional spectrum. It was no longer okay to say, are you on the left or the right? Because there were so many issues. When FDR was president, it worked. You could use it. But it doesn't work now because there's no longer just one big issue we're debating. Verlin, you want to add to that?
No, I think that's exactly right.
All right, guys. So let me just put my cards on the table and tell you my big central criticism. All right, and it's this. All right. One of the main themes of your book is the rest of the world's bad because they're doing this binary thinking. Either you're left or you're right. All right, but it seems like you guys are offering us a binary choice between essentialism and the social theory of ideology. So I would say there's a continuum for that too. There's the essentialist pole, there's the social pole, and you can be anywhere in between there. So like my view is that the right position is 15% essentialist, 85% social. So
what's your 15%?
If you put it that way, do we even disagree? Or I'm like, am I the same as you really? And you're just overstating a bit for effect and maybe we're on the same page already.
Yeah, I think we would say that, anytime you start talking in terms of unidimensional spectrum, you're assuming that there is some natural connection between things that don't go together, right? So we're saying there really is no connection between your position.
So the right position abortion is 0% essentialist.
Yeah.
That's our argument.
We're 0% social.
We're open to any evidence that anyone can give us to say, no, actually these things, because there is lots of survey data.
Why isn't the fact that a party has one view on deregulation of coal and another one on deregulation of oil, that's a tiny piece of evidence that there's a pattern, right? Isn't that it? Even you guys will say, well, look, we've got, you know, economic freedom, we've got, you know, social liberalism. Those are two things. It's like, well, if there can be some coherence among some sub issues, why isn't that enough to move the essentialist dial up from zero to some positive number?
Well, maybe we're talking past each other. We're not saying that the Republican Party doesn't stand for anything, and the Democratic Party is.
There's no philosophical logic to it. That is, it seems like Vernon's position is, yeah, there's zero logic. And I say, there's a little logic. It's not zero. There's a tiny bit of logic, but it's there. And then the rest of it, you're right. So I'll say like 85%, you're right. I've thought this before your book. And I've always been happy to go and make fun of the incoherence of political views and say, yeah, sure. Animal rights could easily be a Republican view and pro-life could easily be a Democratic view. But on the other hand, it's not that there's no logic at all. Even that example you're giving of why is it that the free market people from the 30s become anti-communist? Well, you can kind of see why a free market person is going to be anti-communist, can't you? That's like, it's not ironclad Aristotelian logic, but it makes sense that those views cohere, does it not?
It does, but it falsifies the essence, right? So there is a logic to how things evolve. There's no question about that. The same way there's a logic to how things evolve in nature. Our position isn't that people don't have reasons for adopting new things. I understand the reasons for why people have adopted Trumpism, even though it goes against Reaganism. It's not that there's no logic or reason there. I think maybe we're talking past each other. It's simply there's nothing connecting all these different things. So when I talk about somebody moving to the far right, I'm talking literal nonsense. Well, does it mean they moved to become extreme in favor of tax cuts or extreme in favor of cutting the budget deficit? Those are opposite things. When they say, you know, people say Reagan was on the far right because he was in favor of free markets, and free markets are far right. And then along comes Bush, and he was the most anti-market president since FDR. And they said he took the party to the extreme right. What is this right people are talking about? That's the point we're making. So they're talking about different things. They say, well, the war in Iraq was far right. Okay, that's a separate issue from free markets. Those are two different things. I don't see what the 15% connecting them is. If you're talking about there's a 15% of what the Republican Party believes that persists across time, that we would disagree with. So when Trump turns against the Iraq war and he say he moved the party to the extreme right, what is extreme right? It doesn't have any transcendent historical meaning. It's whatever the Republican Party is doing. So I guess I don't understand what you're saying. What is that 15%? Is there, you're saying there's 15% essence. There's something that does persist and is called right wing across time and place, but it's only 15% of what we call right wing.
Exactly.
Okay. So what is that 15%? All That's right. My question for you.
Well, you were jumping the queue, but so let's give Robin plenty of time after this. So I have my simplistic theory of left and right. And as I said, the simplistic theory says the following: the left is anti-market and the right is anti-left. Now, again, I'm not going to fall into your trap of saying that any of this ever works 100%. But we're dealing with human beings here. So I know that Frederick Bastiat sat on the left in the French Assembly. But still, here's the thought experiment that I like to illustrate my position. And I say, imagine we got a time machine and we bring all self-identified leftists from the last 200 years together in a room, all the self-identified rightists, put them together in a room. Now, notice that word self-identify is important because it does actually... by your own work, it immediately solves a bunch of problems like Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. They didn't even use the words. We don't have to worry about them. They're out of the sample. So it's got to be self-identified people. But we're not going to do the cheating thing of saying if I don't like someone, they can't be on my side. No, that's cheating. It's self-identified. And then my question is, if we had to get an issue position paper out of each of these two giant time traveler conventions, what could we get 80% agreement on in both groups? And my position is, if we've got the group that's got Karl Marx, Joseph Stalin, Joe Biden, FDR, Elizabeth Warren, Noam Chomsky, just pile all them all in, you would say there's no essence. Say, but I say they will be able to come up with an issue position of a paper that 80% will agree with. And what's it going to be? A bunch of complaints about markets. That's what they'll be able to agree on. Now go over to the right-wing view, and there, what are they going to be able to agree on? They're going to be able to agree on a bunch of complaints about the left. That's my, so again, like I could be wrong, but again, that group, you've got Mussolini, William F. Buckley, you've got Herbert Hoover. He self-identified at some point, probably, right? Maybe a little late, but still, right? Robert Taft, the South African National Party leaders under apartheid, get them all in a room. Like, what can you guys agree on? And I say it's going to be a bunch of complaints about the left. So that's my position. I mean, it's you can say that's totally social. Like, it's not totally social. It's one that is big enough to be a general theory of this entire long-run historical movement. Am I claiming that they can agree on everything? Of course not. Am I agreeing that there's some philosophy they all deduce it from? No, it's just a convention. But still, there's a convention with some commonalities. A lot less than normal people think. That's why I'm on your side. A lot of this stuff is arbitrary, but it's not totally arbitrary. That's where I'm coming from.
I'm chopping at the bit, but Verlin, I got to let you go.
Well, I'll just say one thing real quick. I mean, there's lots to say there. So we do go into the book how there is a difference between correlation and causation, right? And so we do go into the literature that shows correlation between issue positions and identity with a certain left or right side of a spectrum. But I think we show pretty convincingly that this is socially determined and not philosophically determined.
100% social? Is it a philosophy plays zero role? Look, you have a lot of evidence that a lot of stuff is social. I agree, but what evidence do you have that it's 0% philosophical?
Yeah, because there's nothing that has persisted across time. Now you do show these correlations, right? Now I think we could do something similar if you get, take everyone who identifies as on the left and liberal, and you could get them to agree on what you just said. You could also get them to agree that they prefer Coke to Diet Pepper. Does that make drinking Coca-Cola an essential part of being in the left-wing tribe or liberal? No, it's socially determined because Dr. Pepper happens to be consumed more in the South, which tends to, since the 1930s and 50s and 60s, tended to have more people who identify as conservative. These things happen to go together for reasons of historical contingency and social constructivism, but not because they naturally go together. So I would just say there is a big difference, and I think we go into this in the book, in saying there's a difference between correlation and causation on those things.
Well, and even more importantly, so it seems, Brian, you're saying that these terms are generally predictive, right? You're saying with 80% accuracy, if I know somebody's on the left, then I can know they're anti-market. So you're saying, you know, it has this usefulness. Let me tell you, and you know this, so I'm going to be just kind of coy here. Adolf Hitler was extremely anti-market. His platform, mm-hmm. The Nazi platform, mm-hmm. wanted to nationalize industry. It wanted mm-hmm. to redistribute wealth radically. And so, again, it's just not predictive.
This is all great stuff. But again, what I said is, here's the thought experiment. All right, so I'm pretty sure Hitler's going to self-identify on the right. So he's going to be in that room with Mussolini, William F. Buckley, all these other people. And what are they? And then he might go and say, you know, we need to have a bunch of complaints about the Jews and their interest charging. And the other people on the right are going to say, no, we can't agree with that stuff. So, well, what will you agree with then? What about if we complain about Marxism? And you're like, yeah, we can do that. So that's what they'll be able to agree on. And Hitler will go and sign his signature saying those lousy communists and socialists, and William F. Buckley will do it too.
Look,
and we get some meeting of the minds, although far from, you know, yeah. we get like a some meeting yeah. of the minds, not all, we get some.
You're halfway there. You're most of the way there.
Yeah, maybe because you're saying, there, but you're going too far, man.
No, I don't think so. So you're saying that the right is defined by being anti-left. That's the point you just made. Mm-hmm. Completely agree. 100%. You're with us, man. When it comes to the right, you're saying it's all tribal. They all hate the people on the left. There's a right-wing tribe, there's a left-wing tribe. If you're on the right, it's because you hate the left. They don't share anything other than hatred of the left. They're a tribe. And that's why Buckley and Hitler would be, quote, in agreement. There's no essence there. You're not saying that Buckley was a fascist or had some kind of fascist essence. It's just Buckley didn't like the left. Hitler didn't like them. Great. But you are saying there's an essence of the left, which is anti-market. And that's obviously not true because Hitler himself was anti-market. The Japanese militarists who are considered far right were anti-market.
You're flipping around the numerator and denominator. So I'm saying everyone who's on the left is anti-market, not that everyone who's anti-market is on the left.
But again, okay, fine.
Everyone is too strong. I don't say everyone because the world's too complicated. There's always just weirdos who are somehow wandering to the wrong convention.
But okay, let me put it. Okay, so let's go back to the usefulness point then. So you say you can, so terms, we should only use them if they're predictive, right? I think mm-hmm. you and I would both agree. And you say it's predictive with 80% accuracy. All right, maybe, mm-hmm. but why not jettison the 80% for 100%? Why not, instead of using left and right, just say what people are in favor of? This would solve so many problems in our politics. So instead of saying Trump moved the party to the right, well, what in the world does that mean? This person is on the far left. What in the world does that mean? I can take a guess and I'll be maybe 80% right, maybe not. But I don't even think you can get there, right? Because, okay. But why not go 100%, Brian? Why not say he's in favor of tax cuts? I know what that means. That has an essence. That's real. Why not say Trump, it wants to reduce immigration? That has a meaning. Trump believes in more government spending than previous Republican politicians. That has a meaning. When you say far right, I don't know. I don't know if he means more government, less government, more Reagan, more Hitler. I don't know. So you're saying, well, it's useful. We're saying, no, it's not. Doctors don't use a left-right spectrum. They simply talk granularly about individual illnesses and treatments. And I don't understand why we can't bring that same granularity to politics. We used to do it. We used to talk about tariffs. We used to talk about slavery. We used to talk about a national bank. We would talk issue by issue. And now we say, no, he's on the left, he's on the right. This totalizing approach to politics, which may get us some predictive value, but doctors don't talk that way. They don't go 80%, they go 100%. They don't say you have a left-wing illness. Well, gee, does that mean a fractured tibia or cancer? They say you have lung cancer. Otherwise, we'd be treating cancer If we said left-wing illness, we'd be treating cancer with splints and casts. That'd be silly. And that's exactly what we're doing. You remember in 2008, people said George W. Bush is on the far right. He took the country to the far right. Okay, whatever that means, I don't know. So then when the financial crisis hit, they said that's because he was far right and far right policies are free market. So we have to go to the other extreme and have all kinds of government intervention. How was that useful? That's treating cancer with a splint. That's treating a broken leg with chemotherapy. So I say get rid of the spectrum entirely and allow us to go granular and talk about issues with 100% accuracy instead of whatever accuracy you give us. And by the way, I don't think the accuracy is much as you say. I mean, Hitler was anti-market. Clinton was more pro-market than Bush. Why weren't the left applauding Bush and castigating Clinton? If the anti-market thing was true, they would have been big, huge Bush fans, would they have not?
Disagree with
I would just add on.
So why don't we give Robin a chance? Robin's getting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so, and I'll shut up and let Verlin answer.
So I would have liked the book better if you had given other, tribal affiliations as a contrast and shown how those work better than this. So you don't like this tribe, but you do like other tribes, and I'm struggling to see the difference. So let me just pick Utah as a tribe. You guys are on the Utah tribe, right? You like Utah.
I'm an Idahoan, actually, but I like Utah.
Yeah.
Okay. I was born and raised in Oregon, but sure.
Okay.
But still on the Utah tribe.
Right.
You don't have to live in Utah to be on Tribe Utah, do you?
Right. Well, no, I actually live in Idaho, so for whatever that's worth. But okay. Keep going.
Well, so, but under the presumption you both identify with Utah more, we could imagine the world dividing up into people who like Utah and people who don't like Utah, right? And Utah people get together in Utah and say, Utah's great. Now, what's great about Utah? If we ask, why do you like Utah? You might mention the clean air and high marriage rate and low crime rate, things like that. And you could talk about those as this granularity factoring in all these pieces, but your fellow Utah people want you to not just have a bunch of things you happen to like about Utah. They'll want you to think in terms of some overall essence of Utah, right? Some Utah style that's overall what they like about Utah. And they'll like you because you like that about Utah and they like that about Utah. So will that be wrong? Will that be counterproductive? Doesn't it make sense for almost anything we like together that we're trying to be a tribe around to talk about what it is that it has in common compared to other things and talk about how we share liking that thing? Is that not an essence? What am I missing here? Because we could talk the same way about my political tribe, right? We're struggling to say, well, what is it we have in common? We've got some things in common. We're trying to name them. We're not necessarily saying everything reduces to one dimension, but we're usually going to have to pick a few things, right? I'm not going to give you a list of 300 things I like about Utah, right? It's going to be a short list. So what's wrong with talking about pro-Utah in terms of a limited set of features of what we like about Utah? Is that essentialism? Is that the wrong essentialism? Is it true about Utah? What?
Yeah, so I can't speak for Utah because I don't necessarily belong to a Utah tribe. Like, I'm a big opponent of the University of Utah athletic teams. I hate them. But here's a tribe that I am a part of. I love the Los Angeles Dodgers. Been a Dodgers fan my whole life. And here's an interesting example, I think, of what we're talking about. When Cody Bellinger was winning the MVP for the Los Angeles Dodgers, I loved Cody Bellinger. He was great. He's awesome. He gets traded to the Chicago Cubs. He comes back to Dodger Stadium and we all boo him, right? Okay, so that's irrational tribalism. I get it, but that's not harmful. That's not doing any harm in the world. Ideological tribalism is doing a lot of harm in this world. It gives people false omniscience to say, I am right about everything in politics. If you belong to a different tribe, you're wrong about everything. And therefore, I can justify anything that my tribe does. I can justify any trampling of the Constitution, any violations of the rule of law, any violations of the separations of power or federalism or individual rights. Everything is justified because you're wholly evil and wrong about everything. And I am wholly correct and righteous on everything. Before the left-right spectrum, that's not the way our politics operated. People understood that there was two political parties that were coalitions of groups and issue positions. And they said, you know what? I prefer this group to that group. There's some things I like about that other party, but there's more of the stuff that I like in my party, so I'm going to vote for my party over the other party. But it was not this totalizing Manichaean view of the world that said I have to destroy the people in that other party. So I think that's where tribalism can be harmful or it can be harmful.
It sounds like What you like is weak fandom, really weak.
Can I answer that question? Oh, sorry.
Just like long ago, Christianity versus non-Christianity was a really important distinction to a lot of people. And then they really exaggerated the distinction. They projected that on lots of things. And during the Cold War, East versus West was a really important distinction. We project a lot onto that. And so now politics is really important and we project onto that. But it seems that over history, when a tribe is really important to us, that's when we idealize it the most, simplify it the most, and emphasize, you know, feeling correct and promoting our side the most. You say you like sports teams, but you're hardly willing to tell us what you like about them. It doesn't sound like you really like them that much. That is, what
you would be surprised how much time I've been watching them. Sports and cheering on my sports teams. You'd be shocked.
But, so Hiram is the historian here. I mean, I would also just say that some of your history seems great, but other parts seem really wrong. Like the stuff about how the political tribes used to not totally hate each other and treat it as a cosmic struggle. You know, the line from William Jennings Bryan, it's Theodore Roosevelt, actually. We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord, the Bull Moose Party. You actually did have the Democrats closely associated with Catholicism, Republicans closely associated with Protestantism at a time when people took those religious differences seriously. So there have been plenty of earlier times, even in US history, when there was great polarization and antipathy. This version of like, this is some new thing and it's only now, it's like, this seems wrong, doesn't it?
Well, if what you're saying is you think we're saying that hostility in politics is only beginning now, you're right. That's not correct. We're not saying that. I hope we didn't say that.
You know, totalize. There's this word totalizing that I think Verlin was using. Totalizing is actually goes back a long time, right? I mean, probably I would say totalizing is the normal thing and being a pragmatic bargainer issue by issue is the weird thing.
No, I don't think so. So all we're saying is not that there hasn't been hostility in politics, but simply that the political spectrum and the totalizing view of politics inflames politics. So obviously Teddy Roosevelt, you know, very passionate about his, you know, progressive platform and so forth. Slavery, right? There was all kinds of hostility about that. That was the most hostile our country has ever been. Yes, even worse than now. It took them to civil war. But our point is that there was a real issue there. There was slavery versus anti-slavery abolition. That was real. And they were fighting over something real. Today, we are fighting over phantoms. We could lower the temperature if we weren't fighting over this phantom. People think we're fighting about left and right. And I have to go back to, you know, your question, Robin, about Utah, because that's such a good analogy. I couldn't agree more. I think that's a perfect analogy of how we should view politics. Because when you say Utah, there's all these things I like about it, right? Friendly people, low crime, great economic mobility, right? But then I would say there's some things I don't like about Utah. It has a high suicide rate. That's something we got to do. Something we got to figure out. The arts aren't as advanced in Utah as they are in, say, California or Massachusetts or New York, right? So I can see the flaws in Utah precisely because when it comes to Utah, I recognize that it's a basket. If I were to say, no, there's a Utah philosophy, and therefore the suicide rate is good, and if I were to say that the lack of arts is good, then I would have a problem. But that's what we do in politics. Sean Hannity agrees with everything the Republican Party believes because he's convinced there's a conservative philosophy binding it all. But when it comes to Utah or Idaho or any other place, I'm not going to do that because I'm going to see Idaho as a mixed bag. Ultimately, I come down on the side of, yes, Idaho, I like Idaho, just like I might come down on the side of, yes, the Democratic Party or yes, the Republican Party, because I like those better. But I would do so recognizing that not everything in the Republican basket is good, the same way that not everything in the Utah basket is good. So I love your Utah analogy because I think that's what we want our politics to be more like, a self-critical way to look at our tribal groupings.
Let me suggest that's what happens when you like Utah just a little bit. So let's take World War II. And the Nazis, right? There's a really strong taboo against admitting that anything was better about the Nazis. Anything sure. at all, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a huge basket of stuff. Logically, surely something was better about the Nazis. But when you're in the middle of a war where civilization seems at stake, your tribalism really suppresses your willingness to admit anything is good about the other side. So that's less about politics per se than just what happens when tribes feel like they're really important and a lot's at stake. There's not that much at stake, I don't think, for the Dodgers or Utah for you guys.
Yeah. Maybe not a huge difference between Republicans and Democrats. We may come down and say, you know, ultimately this basket's better than the other basket, but not everything in the Republican basket or the Democratic basket is better than everything in the other basket. And we need to have the intellectual humility to admit that. But the left-right framework blinds us to that and makes us hubristic and gives us this false sense of omniscience.
All right. So,
Just really quick. It seems like if I could kind of summarize, Robin, what you keep bringing back to us, which is a good point, is that there are these pervasive cognitive biases, right? It was the whole Daniel Kahneman stuff of you know, thinking fast and slow. We humans are given to cognitive bias. And you're pointing out this, some of the things we're criticizing, it seems like you're saying it's kind of inevitable. And you may be right. We concede that. I don't think so. I think there's hope, because I think we have been more rational in the past. And I think being aware of cognitive biases can make us less likely to fall prey to them. But Daniel Kahneman seems to agree, right? There's these cognitive biases. People are going to fall into them. That's reality. Get used to it. Maybe. But whether it's true or not, it's at least good to point out the cognitive bias. And we're saying that essentialism is a cognitive bias. I don't know if that's fair to what you're saying, to your point.
So this is an audacious book in the following way. It almost seems like you're walking right up to left and right wing readers and you're saying, hey guys, let's just start by admitting that your whole worldview is incoherent. Or really, since almost all social scientists are left wing, you're telling them, hey guys, let's start by admitting that leftism is intellectually incoherent. Is this really what you're telling your whole, like almost all of your peers in academia? Listen guys, basic fact, you're incoherent.
I do think people can come up with coherent worldviews, and they can have a philosophy that guides them in choosing issue positions. But anytime you use the language of liberalism or conservatism or left wing and right wing, you're assuming that not just half of your positions or 30% of your attitudes or 15%, to your point, Brian, are informed by something other than what's going on in politics. You say, no, it's all bound together. And everyone in my tribe believes all of my issue positions because they're also informed by the same philosophy. And we just say, that's nonsense. That's
is there's we that are in the know that are consistent. And then we have tons of lower level members of the tribe who have inconsistencies because they don't realize that this is a consistent worldview. But it really does seem like, really, if your book is right, it is almost on par with you walk into the office of your neighbors, the department, and wave the book and say, hey, this is the book that begins with the premise that your position's intellectually incoherent. How could you possibly deny it? And obviously they're going to deny it whether they're right or not, but that's the audacity of the book, is that you are pretty much starting off with the position that almost everyone that you work with is confused.
It is audacious.
If they were the people that went from being against free trade 20 years ago to now being in favor of it because the party changed, if they were the people who used to be in favor of free speech but are now against it, if they are these people who have flip-flopped on all these issue positions just to go along with the tribe, then yeah, it's obviously socialization. It's not a coherent philosophy causing them to do this.
Well, I mean, you know, these are smart people. You know what they're going to say, Verland. They're going to quote Keynes. When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? So yes, in the past, free speech was essential because then it was the path of progress. But now censorship is important because that's the path of progress. The constant is progress. The details, the application of the principles change, but the principles themselves are eternal. And call shenanigans on them, I assume.
Yeah, what we say in the book is that actually intellectuals are much better at storytelling than people who are not intellectuals. People with PhDs are much better at storytelling than people without PhDs. And so they're a lot better at coming up with post hoc justifications for what they do. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons that people who are not PhDs, who are not constantly consuming political news media, are more likely to have issue positions that don't line up 100% with one tribe or the other, because they're not interested in playing that game and they're not consuming the partisan news media as much. They just, you know, I like this issue, I don't like that issue, and they're not worried about conforming with all of their peers.
Well, a metaphor we used in the book was 19th century medicine. The smarter you were and the more you knew about medicine in the 19th century, the more likely you were, well, I should say the 18th century, let's go back another 100 years, the more likely you were to adhere to the four humors theory of disease. So if somebody would have come, and they did, young medical professionals came in and said, this whole framework is wrong. And they got ridiculed. Why? Because the smarter you were, the more you could concoct an exposé story to explain how, you know, bloodletting was beneficial and how these four humors preserved health. It doesn't mean the four humors theory was true. So ideas are false regardless of how many people believe in them. So are we saying that pretty much every single one of my history colleagues is wrong? We are. It is very audacious. We are making a bold claim. You can say, oh, we're, you know, brilliant. No, I don't think it's brilliant. I think it's the emperor has no clothes. I think we're just the kid standing on the side saying the obvious fact is that there's more than one issue in politics. So can we please start acting accordingly? To us, it just takes common sense to say that. And people with common sense who haven't been indoctrinated into left-right thinking, who haven't been going to, you know, 20 years of academic indoctrination to this idea of left and the right, Hitler here, Stalin here, George Bush here, you know, all this kind of stuff, they are more likely, the people who haven't gone through that indoctrination, to just see the obvious thing. So it's an emperor has no clothes situation. So yes, we are saying that pretty much all of our colleagues in history are wrong. Political science, less so. I see more granularity among political scientists, but probably 95% of my history colleagues fall in line with every single thing. And you point out, Brian, well, they're going to justify it. And they're going to come up with a story. Exactly. But that's what astrologers do. Why is there more intellectual respectability for astrology than the essentialist theory when they have the exact same amount of evidence?
So, I mean, are you getting the reaction you'd expect when you go and tell your colleagues that 95% of you are just completely confused and like you're on par with people who believe in four humors?
We're not Brian Kaplan. We wouldn't say it that way.
Well, I mean, you know, this is getting aired on your social media, guys, right? This,
all right. We'll take our loss. We're not
recording this to watch it, just watch ourselves.
Brian, I don't know if now is the time you have to come back to it, but I feel like you didn't get your question answered about the correlation versus causation. I'm happy to keep talking about that because I feel like you're not convinced on that.
Yeah, well, that's probably too hard, but I think Robin's got a question.
Okay. All right.
I'm blanking on what it was, though. So,
do you just want to move on?
I'm trying to remember.
Okay. All right. So let's just do a quote. All right. So I've actually read the book. I'm not just talking about the conversation.
And can I just interject here? I know you guys read the book. Thank you very much for doing so. You guys have given us the most thoughtful and challenging questions I think we've gotten yet. So thank you very much.
All right. So this is page 42 of the book. Despite protests that they are the true conservatives, people like Jeff Flake are now considered rhinos, sinos, centrist liberals because they hold on to the prior iteration of conservatism rather than go along with the new version. It's not uncommon for the highly educated to cling to the version of an ideology they first fell in love with in their youth, but this does not mean that they are faithful to an ideological essence. It only means they are faithful to a previous ideological iteration. All right, so my question is this. If there are no true liberals or true conservatives, are there also no true Christians or true Muslims?
So I think we may have answered this a little earlier when you talked about were there things that have essences. And we say, you know, there are things that have essences, but left and right.
You said for Mormonism, but that was sort of part of your, you know, saying that your own view has an essence is a lot easier than saying any other view has an essence. So, you know, like, for example, very standard for Christians under slavery to say slavery is incompatible with Christianity. And then there's other people saying, wait, but there's like a bunch of things in the book talking about the slaves. So how can you say like, and of the treatment of slaves and what you're allowed to do. So that can't be. And then no. If you really understood the doctrine, you'd realize slavery is not allowed. And then similarly in Islam, there is a ongoing debate between fundamentalists who say, look, this in a book written 1400 years ago, this is what it says. And other people saying, no, if you really understood it, you'd realize that the important part is compassion or what have you. So, I mean, would you just say that these are debates with no right answer because it's meaningless as to what the true, who's the true Christian or Muslim, or there is a right answer?
No. Let me answer really quickly, and then I want to see what Erlen has to say. So I would say true ideologies that have an essence, they go from philosophy to variegated policies. You can apply Christianity in many ways. So Christianity has an essence, right? You believe Christ was God. Okay. And then you can apply that Christianity in many different ways. Same thing with libertarianism. You probably have debates with your libertarian colleagues. Mm-hmm. You and I, Brian, probably wouldn't agree on everything, even though I'm a libertarian, you're a libertarian. But we both have a common philosophy and you can apply it in different ways. That's not what conservative and liberal do. They say, no, there aren't many applications of this conservative thing. There is all these, they go from policies to philosophy instead of philosophy to policies, if that makes sense. They have coherent policies. So you can have libertarians who disagree about abortion.
The cynical view of these Christian and Muslim debates is that you don't actually even really care about the religion. You've got policy views, and then you're rationalizing them with the book. So this is the standard thing that you say to the other side. Oh, you claim that you believe in the slavery because of the Bible, but you don't. And actually, you're just using the Bible to rationalize your wickedness. And the other side says, no, 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 it's the other way around. There's all this biblical evidence that Christianity is compatible with slavery, but you have your ideas that you picked up somewhere else, some non-Christian version of things, and you're trying to twist the religion to accommodate you. Definitely in the case of modernized versions of Islam versus traditional versions, each side is trying to say the other one is wrong. And by the way, my general version is that the fundamentalists are almost always correct. They're the ones that read the book. They're the ones that care about, you know, about reading comprehension. And then the modernizers or the liberals are the ones that are distorting the actual meaning. This is my view of Marxism as well. The old line Marxists are the correct Marxists. And the modern ones who say, no, no, they're the ones that are weasels and are just trying desperately to reconcile whatever they already believe with a pre-existing identity. But, you know, that's controversial, but that's where I stand.
So, Brian, is it possible to be more left-wing if you think there is such thing as left-wing than a Marxist? Is that possible?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, of course, like you can go and read
more anti-market.
Read the Wikipedia articles on the loony left, and like these are fun articles, by the way. So actually, like in Britain, the term far left is often reserved for to the left of the British Communist Party. It's almost a technical term. Is like that, like if it was the British Communist Party, that's the left-wing view, and then far left is more than that. So these are the ones saying those terrible sellout communists compromising with the capitalists, you know, and that makes sense.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, something different about the examples you gave and the left-right spectrum is the left-right assumes that there's a unidimensional spectrum, that you can only move on this one line. But the examples you gave about religions, right? Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, it's not a spectrum. It's not like becoming more Christian makes you orthogonal to being, you know, less Buddhist or something like that. These are just different things that don't exist on a unidimensional spectrum. And so I think that's one of the ways that this might be different than.
Well, I mean, it's very common actually for religions to pretend like everyone that disagrees with them agrees with each other. So for example, in Protestant fundamentalism, it's standard to say there's two worldviews. There's the biblical view, and then there is secular humanism. And everyone that disagrees with them all get lumped into secular humanism, kicking and screaming, saying, no, we don't agree with each other. But once you accept a philosophy, it is quite tempting to do this thing. You know, you're right that it's not required, and a reasonable person could say there's the true view, and then there's 1,000 heresies that don't agree with each other, but generally they don't.
Yeah, so it seems like if you collapsed all difference from anyone who is different from you into one thing, you would be making the same error that people who think in terms of left and right are, that totalizing error.
So it seems to me in the modern world, the view closest to what you're presenting is skepticism about the intrinsicness of masculinity versus femininity, right? So many people out there say that, sure, in the past, there happened to be things correlated with male versus female, but those have changed over time and they aren't essential and they change across societies. And therefore, there is no essential difference between men and women, male and female. That's a stupid, you know, thing you should just get out of your head. You should just say some people like dolls and some people like sports and not talk about masculinity or femininity at all. That sounds like a lot what you're saying, which is throw away this concept of masculinity versus femininity. It's not useful. Just talk about all the particulars that sometimes have been correlated with male versus female. And then other people want to use this concept of masculine versus feminine. They want to say he's relatively masculine compared to this other person. What's wrong with this analogy to your critique of left versus right, the analogy to male masculine versus feminine?
If anything.
Yeah, so masculine.
I think it's.
Those would be a social construct. Male and female are not social constructs. Those exist in nature and have existed in nature throughout human history, whereas left and right have not existed throughout human history, right? It was invented in the sense, we know it's a social construct. It was
invented. I'm talking about masculine versus feminine as opposed to male versus female.
Yeah, and that's, as I said at the beginning, sure, yeah.
Well, I would say it's an excellent analogy. And the irony is that the people in the academy, our colleagues, who would most push back against any essence between male and female, masculine, feminine, it's all a social construct, it's all just society imposing things, they would be the first ones to say, I'm on the left, Because I'm fighting the same fight that Martin Luther King Jr. fought. I'm fighting the same fight that Elizabeth Cady Stanton fought. I'm fighting the same fight that Abraham Lincoln fought. I'm fighting the same fight that progressives throughout history have fought. So here they are deconstructing something as basic and trans-historical as male-female. It's rooted in biology. And yet when it comes to left and right, suddenly they're saying, they're trying to deconstruct that. And here they're saying, no, it's absolutely essential. There is this left, and I belong to this long tradition of leftists. And everything I believe is advancing this trans-historical cause of leftism. It's hilarious that they are deconstructionists. So the moment it gets to something that's obviously deconstructible, like the political spectrum, in this case, they become the most ardent essentialists. We just find that funny.
But do you really think the concept of tomboy is meaningless? The concept of a masculine woman. So, that splits the concept of male-female from masculine woman. The concept of a tomboy is a concept of a woman who is relatively masculine. Are you just saying that's a useless concept? It doesn't mean anything. No one should use it. It's divisive. What are you saying about it?
Not at all. It's a totally different issue. I happen to believe in male-female essentialism. I just don't believe in left-right essentialism. I don't know. Is it okay to believe that?
And feminine essentialism.
We're going to get into some linguistic weeds here, aren't we?
Your whole book's about words, dude.
Well, okay. So if you want to talk about it, so there are male-female essences, and then there are the performances, things that are culturally constructed. At what point does which of those characteristics are culturally constructed, which are essential? That's an interesting question. I'm not a gender studies scholar, so I'm not addressing that here. What I am
and
saying
is, if you
is,
were, you would give a terrible answer, right? So you're going to give us a better answer than they'll give because they're totally dogmatic and trapped in their own stupid ideology, whereas you're looking at the facts. So tell us what the facts say.
Well, I'm just saying that when it comes to ideology, we say there is no essence. When it comes to male-female, there almost certainly is, but maybe we're talking around each other.
This is a nice illustration of why I think that essentialism versus social construction is a continuum. And you are wrong to go and just say that it's a binary thing. So I would say that for gender identity, I would there say it's like at least 40% essentialist and 60. So there's some things that have changed. Like used to be that hardly any women worked outside the home, and now a majority of all women work outside the home. So you could look back and say, for centuries, people imagined that only men could work outside the home, but now we have learned. And we have evolved, blah, blah, blah. Therefore, there's no such thing as man and as masculine and feminine. And I'm saying, look, you have shown that some measures of these things change, but you haven't shown that all of them change. Guess what? All of them haven't changed.
Name one that hasn't changed. Name one that hasn't changed.
Men are more logical. Women are emotional.
No.
Yes.
No. In ideology. So you're saying it's like the male-female thing. That there is an essence to male-female, there is an essence to left and right.
Go back.
You're saying it's 60-40, we're saying it's 0-100.
Yeah. So, well, before it
what is that 40%?
That it's even possible to go and explain it that way, I'll just repeat my simplistic theory. The commonality of the left, which is not a 100% thing because they're human beings and there's tons of inconsistency and so on, but still, the left is anti-market, the right is anti-left. This is one that for all self-identified people to find. And again, and here's the best way of putting it. Look, to be clear, I know a lot of leftists who immediately say, that's not true that we're anti-market, and plenty of right-wingers say, it's not true that we're anti-left. And then here's my challenge for them. Say something to the left, say something good about markets and then shut up without taking it back. And they just sit there and they just can't, and it's like, they want to say, well, look, markets may be good efficiency, but they're very bad. No, you can't do that. That's not a responsive answer. You have to say something positive about markets and then zip it. And similarly, go to right wingers and say something positive about the left and then shut up. It's like, well, fine, they did go Social Security, but, and like, no, shut up. And that is where I say we are seeing the fundamental difference between them and how important these minimal doctrines are to them. It's not that it's a giant logically consistent system. It's not, but there's a core of, there's a core of essence.
Brian, I think what you're saying is something I agree with, and it's why I wanted to get back to it earlier when I brought this up, because I think it's an important point. So we are saying that you can find correlations between people who identify as left-wing and who identify as right-wing and a variety of issue positions right now. What we're saying is the reason that those correlations exist is reasons of socialization and not reasons of nature. And the reason we know this is because when left-wing and right-wing were very first invented, left wing was free market and right wing was statist. And it, for reasons
of historical confusion. I think that's just a wrong reading of the history. I think it does, but it's true that it took a little while before things clarified, but still, again, the left wing of the French Revolution, what are they doing? They're hacking off heads of merchants for breaking price controls, right? That's the kind of thing, that is the like early leftism. Again, there's a lot more going on. I totally agree. But I mean, I'm not saying you've got 100%. I'm claiming that there is a high level of commonality, and it's not just correlational. It's one where at least a minimum, we can see it lasting for a long time, working for a ton of countries.
Working for what? You keep saying it's useful, and I have never heard any evidence from anybody. No, even anecdotal evidence that the left-right spectrum is useful. There's not a single study that's saying people who think in terms of left and right are more charitable. They are more thoughtful. They get things right. All the evidence shows the opposite. Philip Tetlock showed people who don't see the world in left and right, their predictive accuracy is much higher than people who don't.
Yes, of course. That's cognitive. The cost of being realistic relative to loyal. These are about tribes. The people on the opposite end of those spectrums, they're being less accurate. They're being more loyal. They are gaining more allegiance from their associates for their loyalty. That's the payoff you get from.
Sure.
And remember, we're social scientists. We're trying to understand the social world. It almost seems to me like you're saying, look, if we accurately describe the social world, it's going to have bad consequences. So let's not do it. And I'm saying, well, first of all, people don't listen to us that much anyway. But look, you've got to accurately describe the social world. Look, it's one thing, I totally agree with you. There's a lot of arbitrariness, but to go and say it's 100% arbitrary is just a bridge too far. It's beyond what the evidence says.
What could make you change your mind, Brian? What falsifying evidence? If tomorrow the Democratic Party, crazy idea, adopted the idea that we ought to have a free market in immigration and that immigrants ought to be able to work without putting up a border wall. If the Democrats said something like that, would that convince you? Oh, wait, they already believe that. They already believe in a free market when it comes to immigration. Who has attacked you about your book on open borders more, right wing or left wing? You believe in open borders because you believe in a free market of labor. And the left wing is the one that's in favor of it. Now, if they changed, if the left suddenly went and became as restrictionist, would that change your mind? Because I guarantee you they will as soon as immigrants start voting Republican. It's going to happen.
And my answer is every one of those things moves my dial a little bit. My dial's currently at about 15% essentialist. And when there's changes, I'll move it in either direction. I do think that you are uncharitable when you describe the views, or maybe too charitable. So I've talked to a lot of pro-immigration leftists, and the idea that they favor free market immigration is almost entirely a Republican disinformation campaign of foisting a view on them they don't have. What a typical strong left winger thinks about immigration is that we should give amnesty and citizenship to the immigrants who already made it here. They're not in favor of letting in lots of other people from other countries right already. And in fact, they're more like Bernie Sanders saying, look, that sounds good, but it's actually a Koch brothers idea and we don't want to go and hurt workers. So if there was a general switch where the Democratic Party became pro-market on a lot of different issues, that's where I would just say, my God, I did not see that coming. Wow. Right. Or similarly, if there actually was a, like, let me move this way. How about this? If the right wing of the Republican Party were to actually go and just move over to the Democrats, right? You know, so not the moderates. It's easy for the moderates to move. If what is currently self-identified as the right wing were to switch the Democratic Party, that's where I would just say, wow, that's really weird and not expected. Even there, I would have the proviso. I don't want to promise more than I'm actually willing to deliver, guys. So I'll say, look, since,
so since the right wing of the Republican Party became Democrat, so if Donald Trump became Democrat,
we know that he was a Democrat.
Most of his life.
Yes. That is
every falsifying.
Yes.
And that's our point.
That's a really good piece of evidence in your favor. And that's why I'm at 85, guys. I'm not the enemy. I am an almost full supporter of your view that still says you're not quite right. Now, as to why I won't change my mind much for any particular piece of data, it's because I think I got a story that works well for 200 years for the whole world. And so even if the US were to suddenly become a great outlier, I would still say it moves the dial a bit, but it's just one country. So I don't want to go and totally change my story for one country when 200 other countries are still working.
So we're almost out of time. I got my PhD in formal political theory. And I have to say, a standard thing that you learn when you get a PhD in political theory and politics is that there are many elements of the real political system that are at odds with the idealizations that we project to the public. That's just a standard thing. And many people are reluctant to tell the public about the way things are actually less than ideal because, you know, they're trying to appeal to the public. So I predict that your claim here, 85% true, will be added to that pile, the pile of things that those in the know are differences between the way the public is told politics is like and the way it really is. But, you know, intellectuals conspire to only tell those to insiders who have need to know. And it's less clear they ever have that much of an effect on larger political systems because, you know, academics and politicians all pander to the public's preconceptions about politics whenever that seems convenient, which it usually is. And I predict that this won't usually be convenient to mention to the public. They'll usually talk in terms of something more like an essence, and insiders will know different, but will that really change it?
All right. So, well, one last,
Ryan, I'm happy to go back to this question of correlation because I think it's really interesting. And I think we might be able to get somewhere, but if you don't want to.
Yeah, I feel like we're not going to get anywhere on that. Okay. I totally agree with you in principle. I just think that you're misapplying the concepts. So I just had Chris Rufo on here. So here is a Rufo-inspired question. So let's go to page 97 of your book. So this will be the closing question. I didn't get to all my questions. I think Robin didn't get to all of his. So when I actually post this on my Substack, I'm also going to put all the questions. And then any ones that you feel like you wanted to respond to, I'm totally happy to go and have you do a guest post, respond to everything that we didn't get to. All right. So let's see. So here is the part on page 97. Quote, some want to achieve a greater diversity of thought in academia with an affirmative action program for quote unquote conservatives, but this is misguided. As this book has shown, conservative has no essence, so that any set of policies can wear the label conservative with enough storytelling. If there were affirmative action to hire conservatives, those seeking coveted academic appointments would simply apply the label conservative to political outlooks that reinforce rather than challenge campus orthodoxies. For example, a social historian looking for a job could spin stories about how he believes in conserving traditions from predatory capitalism. A pro-choice historian could spin stories about conserving a woman's right to choose. A pacifist historian could spin stories about conserving America's tradition of anti-militarism, and so forth. Since liberal and conservative identities are upheld by fairy tales, any affirmative action to hire one or the other would just result in the telling of more fairy tales. All right, so that's your quote. So here's my reaction. So you aren't impressed by the idea of affirmative action for conservatives in academia. But given people's attachment to their labels, why couldn't they successfully bring dissenting voices on campus? Imagine that in order to be eligible for the slot, you would actually have to publicly say, yes, I am a conservative, those words. I think there's a lot of people that are so left-wing, they just could not bear to say it, even to get a job, especially if that could be broadcast all over social media. And if they were after saying, well, I had to go and explain it and use the words misleadingly, like it is very much like the Japanese tradition of making the foreign sailors step on a crucifix or the Virgin Mary. Like, some people will do it to get the job, but others will be like, I can't step on the crucifix of the Virgin Mary. I can't say that I'm that. I mean, and of course, on top of that, we don't have to allow people to self-identify. There could actually be a committee of people that are standardly recognized and adherent to the view who decide whether you're part of the group or not. So why couldn't affirmative action work that way?
Yeah, I think there are places that do this, right? Like Hillsdale College, for example, hires people. There's people who identify as conservative in the department who hire other people who identify as conservative. Mm-hmm. And so that does bring not necessarily dissenting viewpoints onto their campus, but into the academy, which I think is a good and helpful thing. We need more voices that are dissenting from the dominant voices in the academy. Now, of course, these are social groups. So as Team Blue changes its position on the importance of character and elected officials and on trade and on every other issue, the Team Red faculty at Hillsdale will also change their position on all of those things. So as the two tribes changing their positions, that's fine. You'll always have dissenting views.
Yeah, and there's a difference between dissenting and conservative, right? So if you have a whole bunch of historians who are socialists bringing a free market historian to dissent is great, but you can relabel socialist policies conservative. I mean, Noam Chomsky's called himself conservative.
Yeah, you relabel socialist policies libertarian. Noam Chomsky calls himself a libertarian anarchist.
Yeah, but sure, but you would look
libertarian
and see,
socialist, excuse me.
Sure, but you would look and see that this person, you know, has a track record of favoring free markets and they favor, you know, lower minimum wage, whatever these free market, there's a whole bunch of free market policies, right? You could look at substance and it wouldn't just be relabeling. There would actually be substance there. Furthermore, you know, you say, well, a good portion of them wouldn't be willing to step on the cross and call themselves conservatives. Yeah, but enough would that it wouldn't change anything, right? Because the number of PhDs in history departments, at least, I don't know what it is in political science or economics, but in history, it's probably 95 to 99% that consider themselves left-wing. And even if you only got 20% of those people willing to step on the cross and call themselves conservatives, that's still enough to continue the problem of just having the same orthodoxy reign on campus, even if somebody is willing to utter the terrible words, I am conservative. You know, I don't know that it would change anything, even if you're right that there's a huge proportion of them that wouldn't be willing to utter those terrible, terrible words.
I mean, it all matters who's doing the hiring, right? Because we have seen University of Colorado Buffalo, they hired people who really do identify with Team Red, they're not just saying it, to be the conservative scholar in political thought, because they're chosen by people who want that. Right? It all depends on who's doing the hiring.
All right, got anything else left, Robin?
Thanks for talking to us.
Yep, thanks very much. And
thanks you guys.
Oh, yeah, actually, one other thing. So is there another Lewis Brothers project in the works? And if so, tell us. We want to be the first to know.
Not to my knowledge. Verlin, are you cooking anything up?
No, I think Hiram's much farther ahead than I am. But I just want to say again, you've been one of the most sympathetic interviewers. I think you've understood our argument better than just about anyone. I still think there's a few things that I would love to continue the conversation offline on. I don't know that we'll ever convince you, but I think there's more of this to discuss and flesh out. So thanks so much for your time.
All right. Outstanding. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you guys. Our pleasure.
All right. Good night, guys.
Take care.